Today's excellent holiday edition of our show. I am thrilled to check in with one of our favorite guests, Rich Tao, president of Engages. He is coming to us today with some new focus group insights from his focus groups of Trump Biden swing voters. Rich, thank you so much for joining me.
It's great to be back.
Who are these respondents that you are talking to?
So these respondents are people who live in the most competitive 2020 states, and they all are people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016, then jumped to Joe Biden in 2020.
And so for these folks, tell me a little bit, are they, you know, because you're able to do these focus groups online these days, you're doing a focus group of people from across these different geographies all at the same time, or do you have any specific focus for your latest group?
So throughout this year, what we've done is pull people from multiple states in the same focus group. So typically we have about five, six, or seven people in each session. We do two sessions each month back to back, and they're across, again, the most competitive states, things like Georgia, Arizona, Florida, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and so forth.
Now, we know from the polling that the last couple of weeks have been pretty rough for the Biden administration, with kind of the peak bad, I've been calling it, for Biden coming just right before Thanksgiving, and then things sort of leveling off. But there's a lot of theories about what's driving that. Some people say, well, it's because they're frustrated that COVID is still hanging around. It's still an issue. Didn't Biden promise us he was going to get COVID under control? There are some that say, and I tend to fall into this camp, that it has a lot to do with the economy and it has a lot to do with rising prices. There are still others that would point to what happened in Virginia and say, look, it's because the left has gone too far. Biden is not viewed as a unifier. He's viewed as too progressive. And whether it's, you know, things like critical race theory, et cetera, there are a lot of culture war issues where Republicans suddenly have the upper hand. Tell me what you are hearing from these swing voters you're talking to about how are they feeling about the Biden administration? And if they've soured, why?
So there's definitely been a souring throughout the year. You know, each month I ask a question, which is, what is the one emotion you feel the most when you see Biden on TV or on your device? And back in January, February, March, the responses were generally positive. He makes me feel calm. He makes me feel reassured. Now I get a real mix of people. I get a little bit of the positives, and I also get a lot of negatives, frustrated, angry, concerned, those types of adjectives. And it comes from two different things. One is the policy issues that you mentioned, particularly COVID and inflation, along with what I would describe as unfulfilled promises. He promised he would do X, he hasn't done it yet. Or he promised more than he could deliver. So I had one guy last month who said, or this month, who said, I see the infrastructure package as a failure, not as a success, because he promised us so much and he was only able to deliver a portion of that. So there's some frustration with what he's been able to deliver. And I think part of it also is that Biden does not benefit any longer from immediately succeeding Trump. Trump has receded in people's minds, although not entirely. And he's now being weighed on his own merits and the way he comports himself in terms of how he sounds, how he completes or fails to complete his sentences, how he just looks visually when they see him on TV has not been inspiring confidence in these folks. And I think that that has definitely caused people, particularly as there have been policy failures during the year, like Afghanistan, for example, that just reinforced a lack of confidence in Biden's capabilities.
Now, one of the issues where some pundits think Republicans could see a setback is if Roe versus Wade was rolled back by the Supreme Court. Of course, they heard arguments around the Mississippi case, which would, you know, at the moment, Roe versus Wade protects the right to an abortion up until the point of viability. But of course, as science has evolved and as we are better and better able to take care of very young, prematurely born babies, the question of where that viability line is has moved a bit. And so in Mississippi, they would like to set the line, I believe it's either 15 or 16 weeks, which is earlier than the current sort of scientific ability to save a baby's life or viability. But nevertheless, that's where Mississippi would like to set the line. And so the Supreme Court, in weighing this decision, you know, if they go ahead and allow the Mississippi law, that's not necessarily allowing states to wholesale ban abortion for all any reason at any time, but it would change the legal precedent quite a bit. And polling tends to show that Americans say they would like to keep Roe, but it also tends to show they don't necessarily know what the implications of getting rid of Roe would be, and that when you ask them more granular questions about where the line should be or under what circumstances abortion should be legal or illegal, most people do not fall into an all or nothing type bucket. From your talking to your swing voters, I know you talked about this a little bit in your most recent focus groups. How are they feeling about the Supreme Court's handling of Roe versus Wade, and how might it affect their voting behavior in 2022?
Yeah, we definitely did ask about it this month. We found a few things. One is that all of these respondents, and just to clarify, although they're all Trump to Biden voters, we had 4 Republicans, 3 independents, and 6 Democrats. All 13 of them do not want to see Roe overturned. All but one of the respondents had heard about the Mississippi case that you referenced. And what was most interesting to me when I asked about 2022 was that for a majority of them, they said it would affect their vote in the election. Now, but it would affect their vote in different ways depending upon where they are. So for some of them, I had a couple who said they typically don't vote in midterms, but this issue would cause them to vote and vote for a Democratic candidate. For other ones, they are likely to vote and they have to decide between the two parties. They would put their thumb on the scale for the Democrat if this issue is an issue in the race. So I definitely got the sense that this is potentially, if Roe is overturned, an issue that will help decide the outcome next year in the midterms. But the thing to be careful about is when they say, well, it'll affect my vote one way or the other, and maybe lean me more toward the Democrat, they also had a caveat, which is it depends who the candidates are. It depends on what the other issues are in the race. So it's not as though they're voting on just one issue. So it's part of a larger mix of issues that maybe among those issues, it has risen in terms of importance, but it's not the only issue.
Another big thing that Biden sort of promised when he came into office is that he wanted to be a unifier, that we were a country very sharply divided and wounded after the 2020 election. And, you know, nowadays, when you look in polls, most people don't necessarily have confidence in Biden to unify the country. Whether that's Biden's fault or it is viewed as an intractable problem is up for debate. But you asked your respondents a little bit about things like the January 6th committee, members of Congress, and how they treat one another. Tell me a little bit about what they're saying in terms of national unity and how Congress is handling some of these divisive issues.
Well, there are a lot of questions wrapped up in that. Let me pull apart a couple of them. So I asked about the January 6th committee. I want to understand what they had heard about it and so forth. So the first thing I uncovered was that none of my respondents, none of the 13, could name a single member of the committee. So in terms of paying huge amounts of attention to the composition of the committee, they don't. But that said, I could tell you that all but one of them said that running this committee is not a waste of time and money. So they really think it is worthwhile to do. They don't want to see this kind of thing happen again. And they also want to make sure that they deter people from thinking as though they can just ignore the will of Congress. So there's a real sense that they want accountability and transparency, and they talked about those things. And the third thing I would say is that they have zero tolerance whatsoever for not showing up and not providing documents. And I know that because I asked, if people fail to do this, if you're called to testify and you don't show up or don't provide documents, what should happen to you? And all of them said that you should go to jail. So they want to see the rule of law upheld, and they want Congress to be respected. So that was important. On the related question that you asked about how Congress is functioning, I was particularly curious about the members of the House GOP caucus who are known for being known and who like to get a lot of attention. So I put up on the screen unidentified official photos of 5 Republican members. Congress people get a Gosar, Green, Hawthorne, Boebert, and Gates. And I asked, how many of these people could you identify by name. None of them could identify all five. None could identify four. None could identify three of them. I got a couple who could identify two and a couple who could identify just one. Usually it was Marjorie Taylor Greene or Matt Gaetz who were the most identifiable. And when I asked what they knew about them, I got a couple of anecdotes about Greene and things that she had done and Gaetz having to do with some of the sexual scandals that he has reportedly been involved in. So there's not a huge amount of attention in the public being focused on these members. So while they're huge attention getters inside the Beltway, and they're very well known in the media, they're not well known among these swing voters. And so to me, I thought that was interesting. And so one of the aspects, I also showed two photos of two members of Congress, Thomas Massey and Congresswoman Lauren Boebert, shown with posing in for photos with their families, including their children, holding a variety of weapons. Guns. And I wanted to know what these people thought about those members of Congress and doing that. And they were universally panned. People thought in particular that having the children holding guns was not the kind of image that a member of Congress should be showing off. And they just thought that they were trying to provoke the other party. And some people didn't even understand what the purpose was of the photos. They couldn't even sort of conceptualize what those members were trying to convey. So it either engendered confusion or just an overall sense of negativity.
So my last question then is around, you know, looking ahead to the midterms. One of the things that people have been pointing to as a potential problem for Democrats is a lot of spending has come out of Washington. And you now have House Democrats having voted in favor of this Build Back Better plan. Some signals from Senator Joe Manchin, he is unlikely to go along with Build Back Better, it may be kaput. What are you hearing from these swing voters about issues like paid leave, childcare, the stuff that Build Back Better is supposed to be covering? The Democrats believe, hey, we've got to deliver on this in order to win in the midterms. And Republicans believe, hey, spending all of this money, any vote for Build Back Better is something that we will use to our benefit in ads in the midterms.
Well, every time I've asked about Build Back Better, I get the same kind of response, which is, I'm not really sure what you're talking about, Rich. Mm-hmm. And it's they are generally not aware of what's being debated in Congress. I've discovered this over and over again throughout the year. Generally, what happens on the Hill is not generating lots and lots of attention back home. So are there specific elements of Build Back Better that people want or don't want? Sure. And I can tell you that a few months ago when I was asking about it, there was real pushback on the child tax credit, for example. Because people thought, and they said they knew people, some of the respondents said they knew people who were getting the tax credit and didn't need it, and it was a waste of taxpayer money. So there are things that people do want to see. They'd like to see more benefits for seniors and Medicare and so forth. So there are some elements of it that are popular. But generally speaking, I would say the Democrats have done a subpar job of explaining what they're trying to pass and getting people in the public, at least among my swing voters, to get enthusiastic about it. And I still have people who have no idea there was an infrastructure bill passed. Yeah. So, you know, there's just the ability to convey the message has really been impeded. I think it's impeded by the fact that the media is so splintered, where these swing voters get their information is all over the place. I asked
where do they tend to get their information?
They get it everywhere. So I've got some people who get it only from local TV news. I got people who get it from the nightly national news broadcast. The people who get it from Facebook. People who get it from The Economist. You know, there's no cohesion at all to where these people get their news. There isn't one place where I could say most of them get it. I got one woman last week who got it. It's only her stuff from Instagram. So, you know, how do you, if you're the White House, figure out a strategy of mass communication that reaches such a huge number of people to feel like your message is actually getting through? And I can tell you,
it probably helps if you have a bill where you can easily describe what's in it without the first thing people knowing being the price tag. I think that's been a huge problem for them all along with Build Back Better. Is it's a whole bunch of different stuff, and the easiest way to describe it is it's the two point whatever trillion spending plan or the 1.5 trillion spending plan, which is does not make for a great messaging.
Yeah, or the reconciliation bill, which is a terrible name, which Yeah, exactly. So the naming of it clearly is a huge problem, without a doubt. But even beside that, the fact that so much of what happens on Capitol Hill that gets a lot of attention among those of us who pay attention, it just isn't getting through. And so I think that's a larger strategic communications challenge that this White House and I think every future White House is going to have to figure out. And the fact that they haven't figured it out by now, I think, is largely to their detriment. And they're suffering because of it.
Well, Rich, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kristen.
I've been talking to Rich Tao of Engages. Up next...